In the words of this chapter that we have read, there is particular attention paid to what is called a war with the saints. And that war has been going on really from the very beginning of time. In that war, there was a particular day that was to be a momentous day. Those who were at war with the saints planned that it would be a momentous day for their own reasons, but it turned out to be a momentous day for reasons completely different. In the city of Edinburgh, where just 50 or 60 years before, John Knox had been engaged in the ministry of the gospel, in the Cathedral of St. Giles, that had been the scene of his ministry and of that of his successor, Andrew Melville. On July 23rd, a Lord's Day, at 8 o'clock in the morning, the congregation of the church was gathered for the beginning of the service of worship. Under the orders of the Archbishop of Canterbury, Archbishop Laud, and of King Charles I, the typical Presbyterian service that had prevailed in St. Giles Cathedral since the days of Knox was to be replaced by a different service, much more in keeping with the old ways of the Roman Mass. At the appointed hour, a man appeared at the reading desk of the cathedral and said with weeping, "Adieu, good people, for this is the last time I shall ever read prayers in this church." Moments later, the dean of the cathedral appeared, and he was dressed not in the typical Presbyterian manner with the Geneva gown, but in the vestments more appropriate to the Roman Catholic Mass. And as he mounted the steps to the reading desk, the murmurs in the congregation erupted into shouts of anger. He stopped briefly, having read only a few words out of the liturgy book, a few words of what was to be more like a Roman Mass than anything that the people had heard before. Suddenly, something whizzed past the man's ear and cracked into the masonry behind him. There was a woman in the congregation whose name was Janet Geddes, often called Jenny. She did business in the street just outside the cathedral, and finding nothing more suitable available to her on that occasion, she took up her stool that she carried into the church and fired it at the dean at the reading desk. And at the same time she shouted, "Villain, dost thou say Mass at my lug?" meaning her ear. And that created quite an uproar, as you could imagine. And in that uproar, the dean, seeing he was not going to be able to get any farther, closed his book, took his vestments off and threw them down on the ground, scrambled down the steps and ran out of the building as fast as he could. Now, there was also present a more senior official, the newly appointed Bishop of Edinburgh, and he went into the reading desk and sought to calm the people down, thinking that surely they would respect him. But when the people saw him, they became even more furious. And from the crowd came the cries, "A pope! A pope! Antichrist! Pull him down!" And so he too had to get down and run away. It was not a very auspicious beginning for the campaign that had been designed after nearly 80 years of Presbyterianism in Scotland to remove it from the land. You see, King James I, while he was alive, and he was a Scot, had instructed his son, Charles, in the evils of Presbyterianism. He told the young prince that Presbyterianism was a form of church government that was totally incompatible with the monarchy. The emphasis of Presbyterianism on the equality of the members and of their elders and ministers was anathema to the founder of the Stuart House. He believed ardently in the divine right of kings. But if King Charles believed that his efforts in Scotland would quickly drown the memories of the Reformation, he was mistaken. The old national covenant, signed on two previous occasions in Scottish Presbyterian history, was revived and adapted for the needs of the hour. And on March 1st, 1638, 370 years ago this year, not quite 18 years after the pilgrims landed in the New World, a solemn assembly, as it was called, of people, nobles, barons, gentlemen, burgesses, ministers, and commoners all met together in the Grey Friars Church in Edinburgh. And that was just a short distance, really, from St. Giles Cathedral. And there they signed the National Covenant and promised in the language of the document, all the days of our life constantly to adhere unto and to defend the true religion. They also vowed to labor by all means lawful to recover the purity and liberty of the gospel, as it was established and professed, and that we shall defend the same and resist all these contrary errors and corruptions according to our vocation and to the utmost of that power which God hath put into our hands all the days of our life. And so was launched the struggle to preserve what the Presbyterian forefathers had secured at a very high cost. King Charles wanted to have things his way, but the Presbyterians of Scotland knew the stakes. Their liberties were on the line. And they would not surrender the blessing of truly Protestant worship and truly Protestant church government. They vowed to maintain the independence of the church from the monarch, and that purpose would lead many of the covenanters to their deaths, and would lead many others to hide themselves in caves and dens of the earth, without access to their church buildings, and often without access to any shelter at all in which to live. They were compelled many times to worship in remote locations outdoors. Most of their names we don't know. Some of their leaders, their names have been recorded, but a lot of the people, we don't know their names. They were just people, as we are, trying to make their livings in the world, but who believed with all their hearts in the truth of the gospel, and who valued the heritage they had been given. Their saga continued the story of Presbyterian history and dovetailed, as we shall see, with the transmission of Presbyterianism from the old world to the new. This evening we continue our series on Presbyterianism with Presbyterian History Part 2. You may recall that last month, when we began this series within a series, that I said I had envisioned that we would have three messages dealing with this history and acknowledging that there was no way in 10 times that many messages that we could do justice to the history. In fact, I was just thinking this evening while I was driving down here that there's a whole other section of Scottish Presbyterian history that we're not going to deal with in this context. But we have dealt with it in some ways in our series on Horatius Bonar. And that is the whole controversy that led to the disruption of 1843 in Scotland and the establishment of the Free Church of Scotland. We're not really going to have time to dwell upon that, but that too is a part of Presbyterian history. So we have to admit again the impossibility to make anything like a thorough review of our subject matter. But it is our intention to provide an outline so that you can begin to appreciate everything that the Lord has given to his people in the preservation of the Presbyterian heritage. Now, in our last message on this history, we saw that that heritage dates all the way back to apostolic times, to the first century. Now, this evening, we're going to move forward in that history. In our last message, we ended with the Westminster Assembly, and I said at the time that we were to get to that, we were skipping past some other things, and the things we were skipping past had to do with the covenanting period. Now, if we were to deal with the covenanting period alone, we would need a whole series of messages. Many, many dramatic stories. And by reason of the efforts of some to preserve those stories, we have those stories today. We can read them in Scott's Worthies and in Jock Purvis' little book, Fair Sunshine. They are stories that are many times very dramatic, full of pathos, full of emotion. The covenanters were people who had no one to go to bat for them. They had no one to preserve them and protect them. They had to rest in the Lord alone. They didn't have any courts to which they could go. They didn't have any lawyers who would represent their cause. The Lord was for them their sole refuge. They learned repeatedly that the people of God must rely solely upon their God. What we can see in our consideration of the Covenanters and then in the settlement of Presbyterianism in the New World during the 18th and 19th centuries is that God always sets about to preserve his word and to defend his people. Sometimes it pleases the Lord for his own glory that his people should surrender their lives in this world, that they should be tortured. But even in those times, the Lord is still acting to preserve their testimony for the glory of his name. So this evening, we want to look first at the Covenanters. And I call this part of the message Severe Trials of Faith. As I have suggested, there was a long tradition already in Scottish Presbyterianism of national covenants in Scotland. It goes right back to the days of Knox and Melville, where the people would sign these documents called national covenants, sometimes called a solemn league and covenant, where they bound themselves together and to the principles that were set forward in this document. And it was that tradition that was revived in 1638 with the signing of the national covenant in Edinburgh. The signing of these covenants was really a solemn expression of the faith of the Scottish people in Christ, their Redeemer. They were saying that the Church of Christ could not have as its spiritual head any earthly ruler. And in this point, they came into conflict with the king, because the king was determined to impose himself as the head of the Church of Scotland, much as he was the head of the Church of England. But the Scots were committed to the principle of Presbyterianism that we've already underlined, the principle that was expressed in the first century, that there is no head of the church but Jesus Christ. You may remember that in the Westminster Confession, that particular truth was laid down in unmistakable terms. When the Confession said there is no head of the church but Christ, nor can the Pope of Rome in any sense be the head thereof. The efforts then to impose either the Archbishop of Canterbury or the King himself as the head of the Church of Scotland ran directly into that principle to which they had pledged themselves in the signing of these covenants. But that reality was viewed by the King and the Anglican bishops as something that would just be forced to yield to their will. But King Charles came to regret that he had ever undertaken such a policy. He found that the Lord Jesus Christ was fighting for the Covenanters. You see, Charles thought that it would be certainly easy for him to organize an army of soldiers and to send them to the Scottish border to invade Scotland and quickly to intimidate the Scots and to subdue them. It was one of the great miscalculations of history. He went to war, but at the same time, English forces under Oliver Cromwell went to war with the king, and the king was caught in between. And whereas the Scots would have been happy to have the Stuart kings continue to rule, they also were mindful of the spiritual sympathies that existed between them and the English Puritans, for they had labored together, some of them, in the Westminster Assembly. And so, ultimately, when they captured King Charles, they surrendered him to the English Parliament and its forces. And that led to the king being charged as a traitor. And he was executed on January 30th, 1649 in London. Now, for a period of time after that event, the Covenanters enjoyed a relative respite. But Cromwell died in 1658, and we're going to deal with Cromwell during our Reformation Month series this year. The Stuart monarchy was not dead. In fact, in 1660, the Stuart monarchy was restored to the throne in the person of Charles II. And that led to the worst years in the covenanting period. You can imagine that Charles II, after having witnessed, not directly, but indirectly, the execution of his own father by these people, that he was spoiling for revenge. And that is what he sought to do. He pressed the Parliament to pass acts of conformity. And he pressed the Parliament of Scotland to ban Presbyterianism in Scotland. Those who resisted, whether they were nobles or others, were branded as traitors and were put to death. often in a very grotesque manner. The death of the noble Presbyterian minister James Guthrie in 1661 was the first death of a Presbyterian minister in Scotland at the hands of the king's government. And it became really a precursor, a signal, if you will, to the deaths of many others. Guthrie was sentenced to be hanged. And then when he was dead, his head was to be removed from his body and to be put on a pole and displayed in a public location in the city of Edinburgh, where it remained for more than 20 years. Soon to have companion heads of others who had been executed at the order of the crown. Presbyterian ministers and their families were pressured regarding the act of conformity. And 400 ministers and their families, rather than submit to what the king was requiring, they surrendered their incomes, their homes, and their church buildings, and they went out into the wilderness of Scotland. Now, I tell you, the wilderness of Scotland, much of the year, is not a pleasant place. But they would rather do that than submit to the king. The king sent soldiers out to look for them. They hunted these people down. Sometimes when they discovered them, they gunned them down on the spot. These were not ministers. These were just the people who came together to hear the word being preached. They did so at danger to their lives. Other times they were captured and they were taken harshly to prison in Edinburgh, where they were put in Greyfriars Churchyard, in the very same place where the covenant had been signed. They were left as prisoners there in cells that were built around the outside of the church that had no roofs. So they were put in there and they were left exposed to the elements of the Scottish weather, including the bitterness of the winters. It was a period of unrelenting pressure, and there's no telling how many lives were lost. It went on for 25 years. The war against the saints went on. But then came the day for judgment. Charles II died, and his son, his brother, I think it was, James II, became the king. And when he sought more openly to reimpose Romanism, the people of England rose up and sent across the Channel to Holland and invited William of Orange and his wife Mary to come into England and to become the king and queen of the land. And they did so in what was called the Glorious Revolution of 1688. And at that time, the efforts to reestablish Romanism in England and in Scotland came to an end. The Acts of Conformity were repealed, and the Presbyterians of Scotland were able to resume a more normal life. But during that covenanting period, some of those who had been forced to flee found their way by various means to the ships that were taking settlers on the harrowing voyage across the Atlantic Ocean to the colonies of the New World. And there they thought there was the promise that they could practice their religious beliefs in peace and safety. And it was in the New World that a confluence of three major streams of people from the Old World formed the basis for a place where Presbyterianism could thrive. And that brings me to the second point of this message this evening, the second phase of this period we're considering, blessed establishment in the New World. Much of the early influence in the colonization of North America was, of course, from the English, the Pilgrims, and the Puritans, and to a lesser extent, the Baptists. Now, they tended to set up church governments that were congregational, and to this day, New England has been a place that, in terms of Presbyterianism, is not very hospitable. But when the Scots began to emigrate to escape the so-called killing times of the covenanting period, they were joined by descendants of Scottish settlers from the north of Ireland, settlers who had been sent there by King James I to protect the crown's interests in Ireland. They were joined by them, and they were joined by other refugees from France, from the persecution of the Huguenots. And when you had those three groups together, the Scots-Irish from Ulster, and the Huguenots, or the Huguenots, as they were sometimes called, from France, you had a large group of people who were going to the New World who understood Presbyterian principles and Presbyterian history. And they began to put down their roots in the New World. There were three areas, really, where Presbyterianism in the New World began to be established. One was in the colonies of the Middle Atlantic seaboard, particularly the colonies of New York, New Jersey, Delaware, and Pennsylvania. Not so much in Maryland, not so much in the states south of there, but in those colonies, Presbyterianism began to take root. Another area was in the mountainous frontier areas of Western Virginia. And that takes in a lot of territory today that belongs in other states. And the third area was the coastal areas and the river areas of the Carolinas, for that is where the Huguenots went. They settled in places like Charleston. To this day, there is a Huguenot church in Charleston. In that day, it was on the waterfront. Today, it's several blocks from the waterfront. But that was one place where they went. They also went to areas along the coast of what is now North Carolina. And they spread up along the rivers into places like that area that is now known as Charlotte. There was a strong Presbyterian influence in those areas. During the 1720s, it was recognized that the Presbyterian churches had grown to such an extent that it was needful to establish certain principles. And so, in 1728, the Presbytery of Newcastle in what came to be known as Delaware submitted an overture to its synod that all of the ministers who served under that synod should subscribe the Westminster Confession of Faith so that everybody could be sure about where they stood and that that would be a condition of them being installed in their pulpits. The following year, the Synod took up the proposal. That was in 1729, and they passed what came to be called the Adopting Act. One of the signers of this adopting act was Gilbert Tennent. Gilbert Tennent was a member of a family where several of the brothers, the Tennant brothers as they were known, had a burden for training ministers, Presbyterian ministers, and they established one of the earliest such training schools for Presbyterian ministers in the colonies. That was called the Log College in Pennsylvania. And at the same time, in the colony of New Jersey, there was established another college. It was called at that time the College of New Jersey, but later on it would come to be called Princeton College. And that college was also for the purpose of training Presbyterian ministers. And so through the colonial period in the 18th century, the influence of Presbyterianism continued to grow in these areas predominantly that we have mentioned. And then it came to pass that in the events of the 1760s and 1770s that led to the war for independence, there were prominent Presbyterians who played a leading role. A number of the signers of the Declaration of Independence were Presbyterians. Some were ministers. And they became active in the war to establish that declaration. After the war was over and the American colonies had won, there were Presbyterians who were instrumental in the establishment of a constitutional republic in the United States. And in the result of their influence, the Constitution of the United States was organized along Presbyterian lines. In 1788, and that was the same year in which the Constitution was implemented, the year in which George Washington was elected as the first president of the United States, the Presbyterian Church of the United States met in Philadelphia in General Assembly and adopted a revision of the Westminster Confession and Catechisms that reflected the understanding along American lines of the relationship between church and state. So that in those sections of the confession that dealt with that, they wanted it to be clear that they were not giving the state any authority to govern in any way in the spiritual affairs of the church. Now it was at the end of the 18th century that a movement began that would spread Presbyterianism much more widely in the United States, and that is the third phase that I would suggest to you this evening, fruitful development in a new nation. The national government that was set up under the Constitution was a government of elected representatives. That is, it was a government that was designed to negate the influence of aristocrats or elite groups. That was what had been established. At the dawn of the 19th century, there had been a period lasting for some 40 or 50 years of relative stability. But the sad thing about that period was that spiritually it was a period of great dearth. And there were many ministers who had labored their whole lives preaching the gospel faithfully, but seeing very little in the way of conversions. Their churches were not empty because if you did not attend church at all in the American states of that period, you were judged by your neighbors to be a pagan, a heathen. So people went to church, but there was very little in the way of conversion. But at the dawn of the 19th century, a new awakening came to the United States. It was a movement that would last for 30 years. It came to be called the Second Great Awakening. It was much more widespread than the First Great Awakening. And in fact, it spread much farther into the interior. It affected many newly settled areas in western Pennsylvania, around what we know as Pittsburgh today, into Ohio, the eastern parts of Ohio, and into Kentucky, and into parts of Tennessee, and Alabama to the south. Many of these areas came under the influence of those who had been affected by the Second Great Awakening, and many of these areas came under the influence of Presbyterianism. Now, it was certainly the case in the midst of this Second Great Awakening that there were other ideas of theology that were competing for attention. But Presbyterianism continued to take the lead in evangelism and in missionary work. In fact, you'll find that was true not only in the United States, but also in Scotland. As the Scottish Free Churchmen became really the leaders of a movement of missionary endeavor around the world. As the 19th century continued, there ensued, of course, the national struggle that led to the Civil War. It affected Presbyterianism. There was a split between the northern and southern branches of Presbyterianism, and that split would become important in the years following the war. It was a split that persisted even after the war ended. And it was in that period that the effects of Darwinian thought began to appear in American Presbyterianism. The effects of German liberalism began to appear in American Presbyterianism. And at the turn of the 20th century, there would be a notable heresy trial in the Presbyterian Church, and there would be set the background for upheavals in doctrine and theology that would take Presbyterianism in America into a time of great difficulty. The point that I'm making this evening is, as we read in Daniel 7, that the devil has always sought to make war with the saints. In verse 21, the same horn made war with the saints and prevailed against them. We can see that in the covenanting period. We can see it to some extent in the development of Presbyterianism in America. There is a cycle by which the horn makes war and seems to be gaining the upper hand until, in verse 22, the Ancient of Days came, until God intervened. In the covenanting period, there were desperate days, and it seemed that all was going to be lost. But then God came, and God came to impose His judgment. And those people who had been persecuted, the saints of the Most High, they came to possess the kingdom. Let that encourage you. That in the day in which we live, there are many who boast of what they're going to do, but they will only be able to go so far until the day when the Ancient of Days comes to impose judgment. And that is the day for the vindication of Christ. for the vindication of the Son of Man. He will rule his church. He will build his church. So then in these days, let it not be said that we will cast away the heritage that has been given to us. Let us keep holding on to Jesus Christ, and let us rest in Him and rejoice that God has called us to continue as Presbyterians in this age.